979-308-6407 to learn more. That number is 979-308-6407 to join the Houston chapter of ADAPT and advocate for the civil rights of people with disabilities. All ADAPT actions are nonviolent.
Clouds below your knees signals that it is 8 p.m. on Thursday and time for So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling and that's a mouthful. And it's only here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM, an auspicious start for Harwood. Tonight we celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers who take us on journeys through windows of their souls and transport us to a montage of magical worlds before returning us safely to the present. Hi, I'm Harwood Taylor, Gallery Director at Grimion & Company Fine Art, and I'm super excited to be here co-hosting the show with my long, great friend, Chris Gorman. We really love this show, and we appreciate Dr. Hank for asking us to be here tonight. It's an honor and a guaranteed good time. We'd also like to tip our collective hats to our fellow host, Greg Audell, Warren Holloman, Mary Edgerton, Eric Heen, and the entire So What's Your Story team. We have a great couple of guests tonight who are here to share their stories, Michael Locke and Michael Galco. They are accomplished both in their chosen fields and as writers and storytellers. We are excited they could be here tonight and can't wait to hear your stories.
As soon as I found out that we were lucky enough to have two Michaels on the show to tell stories tonight, I immediately got curious what it was like to be a Michael. So I did what I always do when I have questions. I Googled it. So it turns out the name Michael is of Hebrew origin, and it means who is like God. And also the Archangel Michael comes to mind, a protector of heaven, who became known as the patron saint of soldiers. So, according to my research, the name Michael is intended to confer on the child who receives it both strength and humility. That's a lot of responsibility for a tiny baby, right? But the last source I checked was the Urban Dictionary, because I wanted some information that was more current, like from this century. It turns out that if you were dating and had just met a great new guy, today's slang would call that guy a Michael. That's cool, okay?
That's cool.
So tonight's storytellers, Michael Locke and Michael Galco, are here to share stories of strength and vulnerability in true Michael style. And I know these Michaels. I bet they're going to make you laugh, too. So grab a snack or a basket of clothes to fold, because it's Thursday night. And it's So What's Your Story time.
Our first storyteller tonight will be Michael Galco. He's a professor of genetics at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center and a prolific and largely unpaid poet. I met him as a neighbor a few years ago, and I feel like I won the neighbor lottery. I was glad to make a new friend that was so creative and full of energy. Michael, I hear you have a story tonight about a familiar situation that you ended up taking to a whole new level. Will you tell us about that?
Certainly. So the other day, I got a letter. Some people still send letters. I'll tell you who still sends letters. Collection agencies. Collection agencies still send letters. So this is the story of how I got that letter. So a couple of years ago, and also what I did when I got the letter. So a couple of years ago, I was fairly recently divorced, and I was trying to keep myself in really good shape. So I was staying with my mom outside of Austin, and I was running on this trail, and I jammed my my hip. So I came back to Houston, and I tried to run a few days later, and I realized the hip was pretty hurt. So I went to the doctor. And the orthopedic doctor did an x-ray and then an MRI, and he said, I got bad news for you. You have some inflammation in your the long bone of your hip, and you're going to have to walk on crutches for 4 to 6 weeks to let it go down. So I was not too happy about that. It was the height of summer, and it was a little hard to get around. So I went into the room where the orderly was in the office, and he gave me this pair of crutches that were sort of made of like kind of aluminum foil. They didn't have a lot of structure to them. And I said, how much is it for the crutches? And he said, are these? Oh, you're kidding me. He says, these are free. Just walk out. And he says, if I were you, I would go to CVS and I would get a good sturdy pair of crutches. So I was hobbling around on these and I waited the 4 to 6 weeks. And then, my hip eventually kind of got better. So about 6 months later, I got a bill in the mail from a company called DGO Global. And I opened the bill, and it said $30, and I couldn't tell what it was for. So I took it, and I threw it in the trash. I didn't think about it anymore. And then about 2 weeks later, I got another bill. And same thing. I didn't know what it was, so I threw it in the trash. And remarkably, these bills kept coming with more and more frequency. And so, and then finally, I got one that was kind of covered with these sort of like, random, the lottery thing. Like, you know, pay attention to this, urgent, you must respond and all this. So I open it up and I look at it, and it said at the bottom, you know, if you don't contact us, we're going to refer this to a collection agency. So I thought, oh, I guess I better call and figure out what it is. So I went into my office the next day, and I called, and I said, you know, I keep getting this bill for $30. I said, what is this? And they said, are you Michael Galco? And I said, yeah. And they said, did you get a pair of crutches about 6 months ago? I said, yeah, I did. That was a long time ago. And he said, well, you owe us $30 for the crutches. So I said, you know, I'm used to getting bills like right after I have the service. And the guy at the doctor's office told me these crutches were free. And the crutches were kind of not worth $30. And, well, you had one of these conversations, you know, these kind of customer service, consumer conversations that kind of escalated in tone a little bit and got kind of close to personal remarks. And the guy said, well, you know, if you're not going to pay it, we're going to have to refer it to a collection agency. And finally I said, you know what, you do that. You just refer it to a collection agency. Then I forgot about it, just like the regular bill. And several weeks later, I got a letter, from this company called Argon Collection Agency. And it said, you know, you bought this thing from this medical thing and this DGA Global, and you owe $30, and we are going to collect the money. And so I puzzled over this for a day or two, and I thought, you know, probably I'm going to have to pay the money here. But it's a little bit of a principle with me to, if I'm going to have to do something I don't want to do, to start being a pain in the neck about it. And so I wrote them a letter back, and I said, thank you for your letter. I said, I have a schedule of fees for dealing with these kinds of problems. I said, I charge $50 for making a phone call. I charge $50 for sending the bill 6 months after the service, right? And I charge $50 for sending a letter, right, to deal with this. So by my math, you owe me $120, so $150 minus $30. And I put a stamp on it, and I put it in the mail, and I thought, that is not going to work. About three weeks later, I got another letter from Argon Collection Agency. And I was thinking to myself, oh, here it comes. I'm going to have to write that check for $30. And I opened it up, and it was very short. And it said, Michael Galco, your account is now closed. I couldn't believe it.
Wow, yay.
And largely, I'm telling this story as a public service announcement. If you get one of these and you think you have some cause, give it a shot. You know, try it out.
Yeah.
So that's the story of the letter.
Don't fold right away.
I like it. It was poker, and you won. And I think it's interesting that all of those companies you dealt with sounded like some kind of evil overlord.
They did. They
from all, Star Wars.
They all sounded like kind of comic book companies.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are you Michael Galco?
Yeah.
Did you buy crackers 3 months ago?
I'm going to call in the middle of the night and go, are you Michael Galco? That's so funny. That was satisfying. And I heard you tell that at the Moth. And it was a public service announcement. I hope that someone tried that and someone else won.
I hope so, too.
I hope so, too.
Well, we're so pleased to have you, Michael Locke, join us tonight. Michael is an old friend, and he works in the financial world. Michael, can you tell us just a little bit about what you do?
Sure. I've been in the financial world for about 30 years. We do everything from IRS negotiations to insurance, wills. You know, if it deals with your financial affairs, we can handle it.
Cool.
And so, you know, I've been doing that as well as, you know, I quit that a while ago to become a poet full time. So I did that for a few years.
Wow, that's an upgrade. But do you have any kind of feelings about Michael Galco's story?
That was poetry in my ears.
Yeah. Yeah,
really. Even from the financial industry.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that spans both of your worlds.
That's right.
The poetry and the financial. So that's dope.
I really did love that story, Michael. I loved hearing it at the Moth. And I usually, Chris and I have thoroughly talked to, you know, practiced our stories by the time we get on the Moth where, you know, we know. But it was fresh for me. And I just... people, absolutely, it was a huge crowd pleaser. Anyway, sorry, Michael Locke, we're back.
Yes.
Back to you.
And I, you know, Harwood had told me that you had an amazing story about a time when you stepped completely off your beaten path. And I always envy people that have confidence to make big changes in their lives. So would you like to tell us about what you did?
Yes.
Tell us.
You know, I'm from, as you and I found out earlier, we're from the same town, Kansas
what?
City.
Crazy.
Casey Moe.
You know, and before I moved to Houston, I lived in a monastery. So,
whoa.
Yeah. So I call this story the Capuchin Franciscan Monastery and the Nonconformity of Michael Locke. You know, I'd always thought about it. You know, I've seen all the films, you know, Men's of, you know, Boys Town with Father Flanagan and Spencer Tracy. Mm. You know, Brother, Son, Sister Moon, the story of St. Francis of Assisi. Mass Appeal, and of course The Exorcist. Everyone has seen The Exorcist. So, and the list goes on, and you know, but I fancied myself more like St. Francis of Assisi. You know, I love the robes, the whole vow of poverty thing, helping the poor and the needy, and of course, again, the robes and the fancy rosaries. I loved all that. So, every year my family gave a Christmas Eve party. It was after midnight mass, and everybody came to our house, and it was originally meant to tire out the children so they could go to sleep and the parents could put gifts under the tree. But it really was an excuse for them to drink. But we would invite the parish priest. My brothers went to a Capuchin Franciscan prep school, and we invited them as well. But we grew up, and so the party just continued. The purpose discontinued, but the party continued. Mm. And one year I was approached by one of the priests, and he asked if I had ever thought about a vocation. I said, yeah. You know, I thought about the seminary at one time. And he said, well, maybe you should think about it again. And at that time, discipline was a big deal for me. So it was either the Air Force or the priesthood. So I decided, well, I'll try it. So, you know, 2 weeks later, I'm at the doorstep of St. Conrad's Friary, which used to be an old convent. But so I'm at the doorstep of St. Conrad's Friary. I call it a friary. Well, I call it a monastery because a friary confuses people. It sounds like a fancy restaurant. But so I'm at the front door of St. Conrad's, and I, with my baggage, and I probably look like the anti-exorcist. But I was welcomed in, and you know, I was, you know, introduced to the young novitiates and the priest and the friars and everybody in the house. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it really, they were really nice people. Then I was shown my room. You know that scene in Sister Act where they eventually show her room?
Yeah.
You know, they call it a cell for a reason. It was plain and drab, and it was brutal. But, you know, funny enough, I had furniture and storage, and I had it moved in the next day. I had the nicest room in the friary.
Oh, that's funny.
You know, coming out as a gay person 30 years later, that was probably a red flag that I probably should have paid attention to. But there I was in this amazing place. But you had to do things as part of that journey. You know, you had to have a job, and I worked for a financial firm. You had to do chores in the house. So once a week you had to cook, you had to do dishes, the list goes on. So that was kind of split up between all the young novitiates. And you had to do charity work. And I taught dyslexic students at the Kansas City Art Institute. Mm-hmm. So that was my outsourced work that I had to do. And of course you had morning prayer, you had evening prayer, and you had mass on Saturdays and Sundays. So I'm really enjoying this because it's about discipline, and that was really important in my life. But you know, the devil always is busy in the house of the Lord. So, you know, one night I'm ironing my clothes in the basement. Of course, you know, in Kansas City we have basements. In Houston, you'll just have swamp. But so,
right.
So I'm ironing my clothes and I'm watching The Exorcist. And so this guy from Dallas, young novitiate, his name was David, he comes in and I said, "Dude, if you've not seen this movie, I've seen it a million times. It doesn't faze me, but it is a scary movie. Turn it off." "Well, I'm from Texas, and we are tough." I said, "Okay, Mr. Tough Guy." So the movie's on, and of course, her head's spinning, and pea soup is going everywhere. And he is just glued to the TV. And so later that night, the priests were coming in. We were all having coffee, and they talked about this incident and how it really is basically loosely based on something that happened to some St. Louis Jesuits in Washington, D.C. And instead of a girl, it was a boy. And now that really freaked David out. And so, I mean, he's just, you know, he's kind of a skittish person anyway. So this was a lot of fun to see him this way. And I'm from Texas and I'm tough. And so there was another novitiate who I had befriended in the house, and because he always had Dos Equis in a refrigerator in his room. And so we decided, well, we're going to teach Mr. I'm Too Tough a little lesson of humility. And so we heard him in his room. He's praying and really loud. He always kept his door cracked or open because I think he was afraid of the dark. And so we turned the breaker off to his room. And then, of course, we're in Franciscan robes, and we've got candles, and we're walking by his room very quickly several times. The praying becomes a little louder, and then all of a sudden it gets quiet. Well, I went to sleep. And so, you know, we taught him a little lesson. I went to sleep. So at 5 o'clock in the morning, it's morning prayer. So we're all kind of piling into the chapel. Where's David? I don't know. So we're piling to the chapel, and there he was, underneath the altar, rosaries all over him, fast asleep. So, you know, poor David is probably in therapy today. But, you know, it was, the friary, you know, I didn't last long there. It could have been the vow of poverty, the whole celibacy thing. I don't know what it was. I didn't last very long, but... but that was part of my journey. And, you know, in retrospect, it's really, it was an important part of my life, but that was crazy.
What would you like folks to take away from that story? Just,
Enjoy your life, you know, because, you know, that's a part of most people don't realize I lived in a friary. You know, it's enjoy your life because we're not here forever.
Yeah.
And these little tidbits of your journey are pretty important.
Yeah. trying new things.
I learned
and
something.
And having fun.
That you know, even though it was a house full of guys there for a purpose, it's still a house full of guys.
Yes.
There's going to be pranks. There's going to be things going down. That's funny.
You know, and I have to say that, you know, there were issues in that house as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to deal with things like, and I, hopefully I'm not off the beaten path, but,
no.
You know, I had a, you had to deal with things like racism.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens in the macrocosm does happen in a microcosm.
Oh.
I had a friar tell me, well, Michael, I don't see you identifying with your blackness. Now, he's supposed to give me my 6-month evaluation. I said, well, Brother Joe, being from Scottish descent, why don't you tell me how black people are supposed to act? I said, I don't see you wearing a kilt and playing the bagpipes every morning. So, and so, you know, but it was a good lesson for me.
Sure.
Just to, you know, as a young 21-year-old person, to be in that sort of experience. So enjoy your life.
Yeah, beautiful. Well, if you thank you very much, Michael. I really love that story. I just the image of a novitiate ironing his clothes in a monastery watching the Exorcist. I mean, that's just like an opening of a really funny film, I think.
I think so too. That was
anyway,
a good story.
If you've just tuned in, this is your guest host team, Harwood Taylor with Chris Gorman. And you are enjoying stories by guest tellers Michael Locke, who you just heard, and Michael Galco, and Joe on Houston's KPFT 90.1 FM, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. While Tatiana's away, Hank will try to find fill in by telling us about the world of storytelling in Houston.
Thank you. You know, when I saw The Exorcist, I was in Georgetown. Can you believe that? You know, that's where it all took place.
Whoa.
And honest to God, for weeks, not days, for weeks, all night long, all I'm listening in my mind is, take me, come into me, throwing out the window, going down those stairs that are so vividly in my mind. Oof. The scariest movie I've ever seen.
Yeah.
You know what part I'm talking about. Harwood, you don't know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah. No, I do.
Yeah,
no,
you do.
No,
okay.
I do.
Incredible. Just incredible. Great stories. And, you know, Chris, I never really thought about the idea of folding clothes while people listen to the show, but I like it. I like that a lot.
Well, thank you. That's
I really do
chores sometimes.
Yeah,
and
I mean,
listen,
you know,
to things.
Fold your clothes, listen to our stories, and be sure that you care. And while you do, be folding your underwear.
I love it.
It's
a limerick.
Really, it's
a
great.
Limerick.
It's great. You know, Tatiana is not here, and it's ridiculous. I'm confused. Harwood is taking us on a fanciful journey into the world of speech therapy at the beginning of the show. It's hard. It is really hard without Tatiana. But we have Nick Allen. Nick, say hello to everybody, please. Nick is really a KPFT institution. Nick?
Hello.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, we're still working on the mic, yes. But he's still great. He's a music professor at San Jack.
Yes.
And we are so grateful that Nick is here. How long have you been here?
I have one of my own shows here, actually.
Which one?
I have The Taste with Nick Allen on Sunday nights at 11 o'clock.
I recognize the name. Hello, right? Another example.
I've been here, actually, for 4 years now. Yeah.
Wow.
And you've been Wally's engineer. You know,
yes.
Wally James with the Progressive Forum is an institution in and of itself. We are really fortunate to be wedged between two superb programs, both the Progressive Forum and Lars and the Tennyson Tapes. And, you know, it's really a powerful Thursday, and we're so grateful. And, Nick, thank you so much for helping us out. Really, really do appreciate it. Well, you know, Tatiana is away, but we've got an awful lot to talk about. Houston, as we know, really is the center of storytelling. Our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, hosts a story swap the fourth Tuesday of the month from 7 to 8:30 at Temple Emmanuel at 1500 Sunset. That is directly across from Rice University. It's a great place to tell stories. The group is very supportive. We're all like-minded people. We all love listening to stories. And their next swap happens to be this Tuesday, June 25th. Parking is great. Security is good. These are always concerns, and I want our listeners to know that we want them there. Go ahead and get over to www.houstonstorytellers.org for more information, especially about joining the Guild. And while you're there, please click on radio program on the menu to enjoy hundreds of shows told by over 400 tellers since 2008. Wow. But you don't need a radio to listen to our program. You can listen online at www.kpft.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. In short, we are all over the place. But here's a really important message. If you've got program ideas, folks that you know who would be great guests, tell great stories, and that includes you, please drop us a line at story@kpft.org, and we're going to get back to you because we are always looking for ideas and for guests. Again, that is story@kpft.org. All this information is on our Facebook page. The Moth Grand Slam happened yesterday at the ballroom at Bayou Place, and our two hosts tonight, Chris Gorman and Harwood Taylor, did a superb job. And you know what? I'm always amazed by the tellers that show up. You know, this is a theme that you may or may not like, but you've got to construct a story that addresses that theme. And last night, the theme was the heat is on, and you guys did marvelous, and so did everybody else. Our friends of the Moth hold their monthly slam at Warehouse Live, typically on the second Tuesday of the month. July 9th will be the next slam, and that will contain stories about being bold. It's a lot of fun. Next week, I'm going to host Amanda Winger, Justin Dice, and folklorist Ray DePew on this So What's Your Story, only on Pacifica, Fueled for Peace. You know, with all the terrific storytelling settings in town, I just want to leave by saying that I'm really proud of this program. We were the first. We will always be at the forefront of Houston's storytelling landscape. You know, Chris Gorman and Harwood Taylor are big reasons for our success, and that is the God's honest truth. So back to you guys, and we're really enjoying the show.
Thanks so much, Hank. That was very kind of you.
That was very complimentary, and thank you.
You are very welcome.
We have fun every time we come and do this, and we appreciate it.
Extraordinarily true. Very, very true. When we got started, people wanted to know if anybody would listen to the show. It was just me, and I was a little concerned, you know. But now we've got a great team. It's comprehensive, and it's just,
yeah,
it's as good as it gets.
Yeah, it's amazing the community that has built, that I've, you know, gotten to know around storytelling, including Michael and Lainey, and yeah, just other people that come to Moth things. And it's just been a very rich way of getting to know other people and getting to know myself through these topics that come up at the Moth. I highly recommend people participate. And if they ever do want to and are afraid to, Chris and I will happily coach you. You just got to reach out to us on Facebook. We have a storytelling with Harwood Taylor and Chris Gorman that we never look at. But if you text us, we would.
You've got some people on there.
Yeah, that's true.
That's true. Why do I know that? Yeah, but you're absolutely right. Yeah, we do have people that we're there to help.
Yep.
We're there to help.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and it's not even so much that we would coach them, but we would encourage everyone
to go and do it. That's better.
Right.
Yeah.
Because
coach sounds like put on your helmet. Yeah. We're about to tell stories.
Get in there, team. Put your pads on. But no, everybody has a good story to tell. I mean, I think they just have to be empowered to do so and given a space to do it. So speaking of that, Michael Galco is looking at me expectantly because I think he's going to tell another story.
Let's hear this story that you have. First, I'm going to say that I never would have gotten on stage at the Moth to tell a story if it wasn't for the two of you, Harwood and Chris, knowing you and seeing you do that and thinking, well, I have stories.
So it's sheer jealousy.
It was jealousy. It was jealousy.
Understood. That's a good motivator for people.
Yes, I do have one other story. It was a month or two ago at the Moth where their theme was bamboozled. And I put my name in the hat. I didn't get called up, but here's a chance to tell the story anyway. And I think in most of the versions that were told that evening, the person telling the story was the one who was bamboozled. Mm. But in this story, I am the bamboozler. And I really hope that the bamboozlee is not listening. That's a little unlikely because this happened in San Diego, California, about 15 years ago. My wife at the time was invited to a scientific conference. She was a doctor. And we were young parents. So we had a young child. Her name's Lainey.
And she's here tonight, by the way.
Yeah, she's sitting right next to me on my left-hand side here in the studio. Lainey was maybe 2.5. And so my wife was invited to this meeting. And I think, you know, as is common with young parents, she was apprehensive about leaving her child for a few days. And I think she was also a little bit apprehensive about me taking care of this child for several days by myself. So she said, you know, why don't you come down to San Diego as well and take care of Lainey down there and you can have a good time. And I, you know, I'm generally always looking for an excuse to skive off work a little bit. And I said, okay, I'll do that. So we went down to San Diego. And I took Lainey to the zoo, and I took her to the big park, and we went out and eat. We met a friend of mine from graduate school. We did these kind of fun things in the city. And the last night there, my wife said, we're going to go out to dinner with a restaurant, to a restaurant. And anyone who has toddlers know this is a little bit of an adventure to do that. And so we had this kind of rental car that was like a Hyundai kind of nondescript or something like that. It was, you know, gray color and all that. And so in San Diego there, they have this row of hotels and restaurants at the kind of convention center. And so I got in the car and was driving. And I have to just kind of explain one thing to set up this part of the story here. So my daughter, Lainey, did, like many toddlers and humans, she did not like being constrained. She did not like being in car seats. So often in cars, she would be trying to open the door. And right? And anyone who's ridden with me these days know this. They're always like, why is your door locked? Why does it take two pulls of your handle to open your door? Lainey is the reason for that. So I often, when I parked, especially if Lainey was in the car, I would choose parking spaces where there were no other cars around because I was worried that she was going to kind of reach over and fling open the door of the car. So I pulled into this parking lot, and at the time that I pulled in, there was no car next to us. And then I heard kind of a little scuffle in the back. I hear the door open and this unmistakable sound that's like, you know, the click of the car door hitting a car next to it, right? And I thought, oh, no. And I look in the back seat, and Lainey's got this kind of scared look on her face, and my wife is a concerned look. And I look next to us, and there's this immaculate Mercedes-Benz. And I had been a valet parker at another point in my life, and this was easily a $100,000, $120,000 car. Immaculate red paint and everything. And this gentleman gets out of the car who's maybe 6'3", kind of Germanic sort of looking type. And he's wearing this suit, which looked like silk, probably also cost a couple thousand dollars. And he is absolutely livid. And he's storming around and he's looking at the car. And Lainey, my daughter, bursts out crying. And I thought, oh, gosh, this is going to be a real scene. So my wife at the time, she got out of the car, and she was a feisty person, is a little bit of a feisty person. She was very upset at this man, basically for upsetting her daughter, which was understandable. And so she got out, and this man and she kind of went toe-to-toe. And I know in The Moth, you're not supposed to kind of do people's accents, and I'm not going to do his accent. But he was very Germanic, so when I'm saying his parts for a little bit here, I want you to kind of imagine like Christoph Waltz's voice from Inglourious Basterds. And so he kind of gets out, and he says, you know, this is my car, and this is a $100,000 car, and you have ruined it, and, you know, I am an important businessman, and this and that and the other, and my suit, and this, and I. And, you know, my wife was really letting him have it and saying, you are upsetting my daughter, I need you to leave, and all this. And I I grew up in a house where there was occasionally a bit of fighting and occasionally a bit of people going at each other. And it was really difficult for me when people would do that. And so I was thinking of trying to think of a way out of it. So the other habit that I had parking cars was often when I parked a car, I would pull up the handbrake before the car was even stopped. Right. And this was from living in San Francisco for many years. And I knew that we were parked on a slight incline. It occurred to me that if I just let down the handbrake a little bit, the car would kind of inch forward just a tiny bit. Right. I was mad at this guy, like my wife was. I thought he was being fairly insufferable. Now, I like to think I'm a person who really takes responsibility for my actions, you know, and would generally always do that. But my anger at this person overrode that in the moment. And so I let the handbrake go. The car inched forward. Nobody noticed. And I got out of the car and I said, "Excuse me, gentlemen." And this guy, I think, you know, he was enjoying this argument, I would say, with my wife at the time. And I think he really did not want to argue with a man coming out of the car, even though he was kind of much taller than I was. And I said, "Our car did not hit your car." I said, "It wasn't us." And he looked at me completely puzzled. We had all heard the noise, right? And he said, "How do you know that?" And I said, "Look, our door doesn't line up with the ding on your car." And I took the door and I swung it, and it, sure enough, it was about 3 inches off. Right? I said, "It couldn't possibly have been us." And he was very confused, as anybody who's being gaslit is confused. Right. And he was very upset. And he said, "Well, I'm going to call the police." And I said, "Go ahead and call the police, but they're going to tell you what I just told you, which is it doesn't line up." So he was puzzled, and he went on for another minute, but then he basically left. And I should say, we were not going to a particularly fancy restaurant. This was part of this that was a little bit incongruous. This guy was really, we were going to like Spaghetti Warehouse kind of thing. And so he stomps into the restaurant, and I look at my wife at the time, and I said, "Get back in the car. We're going to leave."
Wow.
And so I turn the car over, and we start to drive off, and she goes, "What just happened?" And I said, "Well, you know, we were on an incline, and I pulled the handbrake, and it went forward a bit." She's, you know, my wife, she was still in kind of combat mode, I think, from the argument. So she said, "We have to go back." She said, "This is wrong." Right? "You're going to have to tell this guy." I said, "I'm driving the car now. We're going." And, you know, I think it's funny to me because Lainey's sitting here. She was two and a half at the time. She probably doesn't remember it. It's 15 years later. I remember it very well because it's still, for me, a time when I did not take responsibility. And I have a certain amount of pride over hoodwinking the person, but also a certain amount of shame at hoodwinking the person at the very same event. But so that's the story, and I hope that gentleman was not listening tonight.
Yeah, me too.
He's busy yelling at somebody else. He's not going to be listening to you. That's an amazing story, Michael. I'm going to remember not to give up hope when things look hopeless. There's always some sort of emergency brake you can pull. Right?
Or unpull.
Unpull. Something. Well, it's amazing because the subject of the story, the actor in this plot, is actually here, and she's much taller now. She doesn't have to use a special seat in the car or anything.
Nope.
It's Lainey. So I heard that you're involved in theater, which figures because your dad's super dramatic. Tell us your best theater experience this year. Tell us what you've been up to.
Well, this past year we did a performance in the fall that involved a lot of blood. And so we were sort of figuring out how we wanted to do this. And we had these blood sausages where you put the blood in and there's a little switch and you flick it. And so one of the actresses would wear them. Mm. And so one opening night, she flicked the switch and it didn't go off. So she came backstage and me and the stage manager were trying to sort of get it off her in the quick change. And as we were disconnecting it from her, we heard this little whoosh, which is the sound that it makes right before it goes off. And so we instantly were like, oh no, there's about to be blood everywhere. And so we both sort of jumped in front of her so that none of the other actors in the room would get blood on them. And in the process, we of course got splattered from head to toe in this sticky corn syrup, bright red blood. And we didn't have time to clean it up or anything. The show must go on. And we kept going and we finished the show and we were still covered in this blood, and it sort of crystallizes on you. So we had it in our hair and our eyelashes. It was very funny. And then afterwards, since it was opening night, we were going out to eat and we showed up at this restaurant and we were just covered in blood. And it was just very interesting.
Carrie's here to eat.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I have very pertinent questions. First of all, what theater group got you covered in blood? What school?
I go to Carnegie Vanguard High School, so I'm part of the theater department
Okay, and what production covered you in blood?
It was a production of a show called Let the Right One In. It's about this little girl, and she's a vampire, and it's a very interesting play.
And thirdly, what restaurant did you empty with your bloody face?
We were going to Midtown Bar and Grill. It's
those people are still
school,
scarred.
Yeah, for sure.
They're scarred. They probably lost all their business off of y'all. I was going to say Denny's. We never went nowhere fancy when I was in high school, especially after a thing. They took us in a bus and they lined us up at a buffet. It was not.
Yeah, our go-to is IHOP.
I would think that's sensible.
I'm imagining an alternate universe where there's another radio program going on, and there's a young man talking about, or an older man talking about being a friar initiate, and someone else that was in a restaurant once when Carrie walked in, bloody head to toe.
Yeah, we have future stories. You know, there's going to be some So What Your Story, 2032, and they're talking about this poor little kid that got scarred when he saw a bloody person, and that was you. Okay? So that's hilarious. Michael, that's a great story.
Thank you. Thank you, Chris.
Oh, my God. I always like it when people I think that are really responsible and upright do something dirty.
Exactly. Turn out not to be.
Yeah, it makes me happy because I don't want to be the only one, okay? I just want to be part of the crowd, yeah?
We didn't really have a theme tonight.
I did. It was Michael's. It's Michael-thon.
My God, you're right.
It's a Michael Fest. It's Michael Rama.
You know, it's funny. I'm watching Michael, and he's an A personality type. And so to see him do non-A personality type things is just, it's funny. You should write a play about that. Lainey should write a play.
Oh, boy. Well, tell us more about your writing practice, Michael Locke. That's what I want to hear about. What are you writing? What kind of things do you like to write?
I've written a lot of poetry. Mm-hmm. Studied poetry. I have a master's in fine art.
Whoa.
Yeah. You know, I've got a couple of books of poetry published, mm-hmm. so I've kind of been working at one for a while. So it's time to get it done and out of the way. The last book of poetry was in 2004, so it's been a minute.
And, wow.
But I did a couple of shows off of that, and it was just a great experience. But Papa had to go back to work and make some money, so.
That's me every day. That's me. I got my hand out, put the money in the hand. Because otherwise you can't do the things you really, your creative practice. Sometimes you have to fund that with something.
Right? You know, and the last time I sat at this desk at the radio station was with Donna Garrett, who is an incredible poet. And she's now in San Diego. Aaron Coleman, who's also an incredible poet. So it's been a long time.
While we were in the room coming in here, I learned a fun fact about you. Tell me the fun fact about being the first at something.
Years ago, it must have been early 2000s, we didn't have a poet laureate of Houston. So I went down to City Hall and asked for it. I think now they have an official position, but back then they didn't.
Well, maybe you're the reason they have that official position now.
Yeah,
and people
so.
Can thank you for making a space, and now they get to be in that space.
Yeah, I think they had one before, and then they hadn't had one for a while. So I said, why not?
And you have a fabulous creative daughter as well. That's in.
Yeah, she's taken on the mantle. So like her dad, she plays piano. I think she plays guitar and she sings. She lives in Atlanta. And and it's funny, she's auditioned for the Rockettes. She's never made it. But I said, but who does that? Who auditions for the Rockettes?
People, I mean, that are like athletes, that are top athletes, yeah, that can, like, you know,
kick, yeah, up to the sky. I can't even get my shoes on sometimes.
Well, she's got a baby due in September, and early on in her pregnancy, she went to New York and auditioned for the Rockettes.
Wow.
Wow.
That's inspirational. Yeah. I might go to the gym tomorrow off of that.
I need to go to the gym today.
I think we're all going to have to go to the gym. While we contemplate our lack of fitness, I think Harwood wants to tell a story because he hasn't and he needs to.
Yeah. Well, you know, the funny thing is now I really do love storytelling. And the way it started for me is that I was driving to Dallas every other week. I would run. I wouldn't really run, but I'd. We had a satellite gallery in Dallas, and Brian Fries and I would take turns. He would on one week, I was on the other week. And my friend Chris here said, hey, you ought to download this podcast called The Moth. It's really cool. They have, you know, 5, 6, 10 minute stories, whatever. If you don't like one, you follow, you know, you fast forward through, but basically there's just an unlimited number and they're fascinating. And I listened to him for 3 years, never once thought, I'm a storyteller, I'm going to tell a story. And then I saw a little ad for it in the Houston Press, and I recognized the Moth logo, and I took a quick picture of it, and I sent it to Chris, and she says, you know, when is it? And I was really busy that day, and I had to look at my own picture because I was just, you know, taking a picture and sending it, like, look what's coming. I kind of zoomed into the picture I just sent her, and I went, it's tonight. And so I sent it to her, and she, unpracticed, goes into the Moth and tells a story, and she got second place to who? This was the very first Moth in Houston.
Warren Holloman beat me because he's awesome.
And not only that, but Warren Holloman's story made it to the Moth Radio Hour,
yeah,
which is the
national
broadcast, with that story that barely edged out her. Didn't even practice for a story. Just,
dude, nobody practiced because there wasn't even such a thing at that time. I mean, it was the very first one.
So tell this story. Well, so for weeks she said, you know, you've got
to
tell a story. That's what you do at the gallery, is you tell people stories about artists and so forth. And I said, I don't have anything. And then Obsessed came up. So I thought, I've got a great story for that. And and I literally, in my mind, I thought, and I'm going to win because it's true and it's amazing. But what I didn't know is how hard it is to stand up in front of all those people. It's really scary. Anyway, but so this is how it goes. I was probably 9 years old, and my best friend and I, Bill, lived next door to me. So special needs guy. And I didn't know any different. We grew up from zero, and our two favorite things were football and the Goodyear blimp. And we lived a block away from Rice Stadium. And every Saturday during football season, you know, we'd get both. I also sort of protected Bill. I knew there was something different about him as we were getting older. And so I always picked him on my team. And when we weren't with other kids, he didn't ever want to play against me. And so he invented this game where we played the ghosts. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And then he would act out what he heard at Rice University. You'd hear the announcer say, and he scores a touchdown. And you'd hear the fans at Rice University one block away, you know, big stadium, you know, and we would act out, scores a touchdown or tackled on the 50-yard line. And we'd throw ourselves into a bush or something like that. So inevitably we'd hear, you know what that is? That's the blimp. And we'd go, the blimp. And we'd get on our bikes. And we'd cross Rice University, which our parents would have killed us because it was a busy day. It was game day. And we'd ride underneath the blimp and just imagine. I mean, a blimp is a giant balloon with people in it. I mean, it's fascinating to me as an adult. But as a child, it was just like, oh, my God. You know, so we had posters of it. We had little models of it. We loved the blimp. And then I said, you know, we need to make a blimp trap. A blimp trap. You heard it right. So you need very specific things to make a blimp trap. Your dad has to have some unfinished projects that involve basically four boards, too long, too short. You lean them together in the driveway where your car, where the car is parked, some handlebars from rusty handlebars from a bike, it stuck in the dirt. That was how you drove the blimp trap. And then you need grabbers. You need something to grab the blimp. And there were two dead limbs from this, these enormous pecan trees in our backyard. And so Bill would sit in the back with the grabbers, and I sit in the front and drive the blimp trap, and everything else, all the dials and everything, which were elaborate, were in our imagination. And the game would happen, and the blimp would come. You know, we'd go, you know, the blimp, and then we'd go to our blimp trap instead of on our bikes. And the blimp would circle around the stadium, and then it would circle around Southampton, right by Rice University, and it would come almost over our house on its way back over, selling advertising to, you know, the football fans. And so we almost caught the blimp a lot. And then my dad, who was a writer, he's a freelance writer for all the local papers, he's at the press club one night, and he's introduced to the gentleman that ran the blimp hangar, the Goodyear blimp hangar. It was stationed out where the Woodlands is now. And he said, "I'm going to give you my card. I feel like I should introduce myself. I'm Bill Taylor. My son, Harwood, and his good friend, Bill, have a blimp trap. If it ever goes missing, it's likely in our driveway." And he says, "Really? Well, if you'll give me a photo, if you'll send me a photograph of that, I'll get those, you know, the boys a ride in the blimp." So my dad didn't tell us. Maybe he thought the guy would let us down, not follow up. But my dad took a picture, sent it in. He sent three tickets, one for me, Bill, and Bill's mom. We went out there. There was this enormous hangar that had Goodyear blimp on it with these enormous doors, and we thought it would open up, you know, and come out. How dramatic. Well, it was even more dramatic, because right about then we heard, we're like, "Oh, the blimp!" Well, there was this big glass wall that was the kind of observation waiting room to get to ride the blimp. And the driver must have known, you know, that, like, I don't know, it was Star Wars, because he came low over this observation wall, and it just kept coming and coming, and it was loud. I mean, it was scary. We were 9 years old. I was literally thinking, "I don't really want to do this anymore. Bye." You know, but we ended up getting in. There were little ropes off the nose, and men held these ropes, and then we were hoisted up on some stairs. I don't have clear recollection of it, but I remember there were probably about six seats, and then the back of the cabin had the history of dirigibles and ballooning on it, a little mural on the back panel of this of the cabin. That day we both got to drive the blimp. I also have this distinct memory that when Bill was driving it, between there were two seats that were side by side where the captain sat, and there was sort of like an old ship's captain looking thing in between those seats, parallel with them. And you would roll that thing forward and back to lift or go down with the blimp, and Bill just went, "Purr," you know, and just spun it, you know. Had it been a fighter jet, we'd have all been dead, but it was a blimp, so it just kind of, bow, bow, you know, it just went down, just the nose went down a little bit, and the captain very calmly said, "Okay, son, I'll take it from here," and starts, you know, winding back the thing. The nose went back up. So that's the end of the story, except 25 years goes by. I don't think about it. This couple came into the gallery, and they said they had just gotten back from Atlanta. "Coolest thing, we got to ride in the Goodyear blimp." And so they told me their experience, and I told them what I just told you. And then I just got so tickled, I started to laugh, like, sort of uncontrollably. And the guy's looking at me kind of quizzically. He's like, "I'm sorry, what's so funny?" And I said, "I just realized I hadn't thought about that in 25 years. I'm realizing today, right now, that my friend and I built a blimp trap, and it worked." So that's my blimp trap story.
This blimp trap story reminds me that I have something in common with both of you at once, Michael Locke and Harwood, because I lived next to Royal Stadium, and Michael Locke is from Kansas City Mo. I'm from Kansas City Mo, and I did the same thing you did, because every time there was a home run and the crowd cheered, I'd be in my bed, and I'm like, "They're cheering for me." I didn't even do anything good. I wasn't even playing a sport. I just knew that it was dun, 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 dun. And when they got to da, 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 that was for me.
You're like,
every single time.
It was.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, thank you. That gave me a little encouragement. You must have known I had a crappy day at work. Thank you. So, yeah. So that's amazing.
It really is. Last night, I was telling a story at the Houston Moth Grand Slam was last night. Chris and I both told a story. Oh, and by the way, so the very first time I told that story, I was so scared. I was talking myself, you know, to myself, because they said our next storyteller is, you know, Harwood Taylor. And I'm sitting on the side and I'm like, this is the NPR crowd. These are like, you know, all vegans. They're the nicest people in the whole world. Why am I scared? And my heart was just like going, because we're just scared. Just, you don't have to know why.
Right.
Anyway, so I didn't tell the story really beautifully, but before I went, they put your names in a bag and they draw your names. And my girlfriend and I at the time, Brenda and I, were, you know, I think Chris was called first or second or something. We'd never seen her on stage before, but I met Chris in a dog park and I knew she was really talented and she belonged on a stage. And as soon as she got on stage, because I thought I had a cool story, I remember I thought I'd win, I was looking at her and I was like, who is that? And wow, I have second place nailed. And that's exactly what happened. She won that night. And
he's
I got
still salty
second place.
About it. It's okay. It's okay to be salty and grudgy when you're in the storytelling
you
field.
You snatched the Blimp Trap victory from me.
I know. And he's still, that's why he's got to tell Blimp Trap. And his friend made a movie about it. So you can actually go and look at the Blimp Trap movie by Sean Welling.
So that's another continuing part of how this community has affected me. So a friend of mine is a director. His name is Sean Welling. And I was really excited about the story, and I recorded it on my cell phone or, you know, iPhone, and I played it for him that night later. He's like, how did it go? And I was like, I'll play it for you. And I played it for you and him, and he said, I want to make a movie about that. And I'm like, sure. Like, what do we do? Yeah.
And he did. So.
Well, so don't you dare move, because Lars is up next with a sweet mix of singer-songwriters on the Tennyson tapes. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, or just tripping on your words.
Yeah.
Join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? It's a treasure, and treasure what you hear. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is
Chris Gorman
and Harwood Taylor. And along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
Decided to donate your birthday to KPFT this year. Thank you. If your special day hasn't yet arrived, consider donating your birthday to KPFT. Here's how it works. Facebook sends you a prompt before your birthday asking if you'd like to donate your birthday to a nonprofit. Select KPFT as your organization of choice. Then add a personalized message so that your friends know how much KPFT means to you. On your birthday, they'll receive a Facebook notification asking them to make a donation in your honor to KPFT. Thanks again for supporting 90.1 FM KPFT Houston, Pacifica Radio for Peace.
KPFT's 2019 Local Station Board election is underway. A donation of $25 by June 30th gives you the right to vote. Want to do more than donate? Consider running as a candidate to serve on your local station board. Visit elections.pacifica.org and cast your candidacy by completing the nomination package before June 30th. E-ballots will be issued to members with an email. Members in need of a paper ballot can email NES@pacifica.org or leave a voicemail at 510-854-9663 indicating their full name, address, and telephone number. Please help make this election green by filling out a ballot request form on elections.pacifica.org indicating the email you would like us to use to send you a ballot. Ballots go out August 15th, 2019.
Summertime, and the living is easy. Fish are jumping, and cotton is high. You're